Following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
Right. Now, number 218, the reason I'm doing this is because this is fundamental knowledge. You have to know this. This is the mitzvah of leaving leket. Leket. Ilan? The mitzvah of leaving leket. Leket is when you're harvesting the field. Now, in the old days, when they used to harvest, they harvest with a sickle, right? You pick up a handful of wheat, and you chop it with a sickle. Now, this is besides, as I'm harvesting my field, I'm walking up and down harvesting. Now, besides that corner of the field that I'm going to end up leaving for the poor people without touching it, as I'm walking, and apparently in the old days when they were harvesting their field, as the harvesters went through the field, the workers went through the field, people followed them. The poor people would follow them in line. Now, what happens is you've got the owner of the field or any of his workers who represent him. Doesn't matter who it is. When I pick up the thing and I harvest it, if I drop, as I pick up my fistful, if I drop any of those stalks of wheat, so then whatever I drop, I'm not allowed to pick up. Up until a certain amount, right? If I drop a whole bunch of them, then I could, right? And not too much, right? But a certain amount, they fall out, I have an obligation to leave them, and the poor people who are following me through the field, it's their opportunity to pick it up. And the Torah obligates you to leave the leket. That's 218, and 219 is the flip side again. That if they fall, you're not allowed to pick them up. Do you know the story of Ruth? Ruth. Right in the story of Ruth and Boaz, and she's the ancestor of King David. Right, Ruth was the Moabite convert. Right, she and her mother-in-law had left. She and her mother-in-law and her father, her mother-in-law, her father-in-law, and their two sons had left the land of Israel. They went off to Moab, and that's where they found Ruth and Ruth and Naomi, and they married them. Ruth and Orpah, and they married them. And God brought God was upset with this family, so the father died, and then the two sons died, and all that was left was the mother-in-law and her daughter-in-law Ruth. And then she came back, and she marries this wealthy man Boaz, and they have a son, and then another son, and that son has King David. So the Davidic line begins with Ruth. Where did she meet Boaz? Because she and her mother-in-law were now destitutely poor when they got back to the land of Israel, so she was one of these people who was following through in the field, picking up the leket as it was falling. And Boaz, who was the owner of the field, he was out in the field, and he said, "Who's that young lady over there?" Right. So Boaz was the leader of the Sanhedrin. Right. And the Gemara asks, "What was Boaz doing looking at women?" Right. Was Boaz? The Gemara asks the question. Boaz, and he was an older man. He was already a widower. Right, and Boaz is out in the field. They're saying, "Hey, who's that young lady over there?" Right. So the Gemara said that Boaz was shocked by some of her behavior. Why did Boaz notice her? Well, he was looking at women. Something about her behavior stood out. You know what it was? The way she bent over to pick up the wheat that had fallen was done in a very sneezed way, and that's out of character for poor people. Who, when everybody's grabbing and diving and jumping. Right, so you can imagine what's going on out in the field. All of a sudden, Boaz knows here's a young lady who the first concern is to maintain all levels of sneeze, right? And while she's doing this, she's also picking up. Boaz says, "Who is that young lady?" And eventually Boaz marries her. He performs because he's the next of kin. It's a form of yibum, right? Where he, what we were talking about, marrying the brother's wife. He marries her. He's one of the brother's wife, but he's a relative. He's the next of kin. He marries her. And eventually she becomes the great-grandmother of David HaMelech. Incidentally, the Gemara says that he married her and he died the next day. Boaz died the next day. Right? He married her, they got married, she became pregnant the first night, and then he died the next day. Right? And then that was
she didn't change her
fields. Uh-huh. The task had been completed. Right? The task had been completed, and the seed for the Davidic dynasty had already been seeded, and therefore I mean, obviously, you know, God decides when it's time, right? But that's what the Gemara says. Okay, so that's 219. And we'll pick up tomorrow with, we'll pick up tomorrow with 220. Okay.
Yeah. General question?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't at the beginning. Where are these all set out? Where are these all laid out?
These mitzvahs?
Yeah.
I could tell you, but then I have to shoot you. Now, these are in the there are all sorts of books that are that count them. I'm using the order that you find in Sefer HaChinuch. Ilan has a copy of it. Right? You don't have a copy? I thought that was your copy. What you showed me yesterday, the Sefer that you were able to work your way through? What? Oh, it was in the room here. It's called Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch was written, Stuart, this is very interesting. Sefer HaChinuch was a book. It goes with a little description of each mitzvah. It tells us what the mitzvah is, what the rationale behind it is, and some of the laws. Now, you can't use it as a law book, right? But it tells you the basic halachas. Now, where did this book come from? In about the 1300s, there was a man, I think it was Shlomo Alevi. He wrote a book, he writes in the introduction, that said his son, on Shabbos afternoons, instead of running around getting into all sorts of trouble and mischief, his son should have something to read on Shabbos afternoons. The father wrote him this collection, this anthology on the mitzvot, and this way it gives him a very good overview of the Torah. Now this becomes an authoritative, because he was a Rishon, this has turned into one of the authoritative works on the mitzvot. Right? Now the Rambam has written a book on the mitzvot, there's something called the Smag, the Sefer Mitzvot HaGadol, different people who have put it in their orders, whatever, sometimes the order changes a little bit. But I use that, called the Sefer.
Always 613?
Yes, that's the... There's a tradition that there are 613 mitzvahs. That's an oral tradition. There's 613, call it mitzvahs, categories of mitzvahs. How you arrive there, different people have different counts, but they all end up at 613. Okay, 214 is the command to not make an idol for himself or for anybody else. You're not only not allowed to worship an idol, you're not allowed to make an idol. If you're contracted by the largest idol-making company in the world, right, and they'll pay you all the money in the world to make the idols for them, that's not a form of idol worship. We're not talking about worshiping, we're just talking about making the idol. The halacha is you're not allowed to do it. And that means that any mitzvah, by the way, any mitzvah where if you do the mitzvah, or refraining from doing it, or not doing the mitzvah, taking action, or refraining from taking action, is going to cost you money. You know that the halach is you have to give up all your money rather than transgressing.
Do you contract a living other than this, is that you can't impulse it?
You're not allowed to do it.
Not allowed to do it.
It means if we said yesterday that if you have an opportunity, if you're put in a position where you're told to do something, or they'll take away all your money. Somebody says, Jew, eat this cheeseburger, we're going to take away all of your money and all of your property. That you're not allowed to. Not allowed to even take one little bite. And if they said to you the opposite, take a bite and we'll pay you all the money in the world, I pay $1 million, you're not allowed to. And even if you have all sorts of calculations about how you'll take one bite and then you'll take $1 million, you give lots and lots to tzedakah and to yeshivas and to the teachers at Or Samach and so on and so forth, right? You'll do wonderful things with your money, you are still not allowed to do so. Right? You have to give up all your money rather than transgress. So here the mitzvah of 214 is a prohibition to not make an idol for yourself or for anybody else.
What if it's something where you can't get a job without wearing a kippah?
That's a good question. And Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses that at length. You should know that in general, parnasa is considered a major test. Right? It's a major parnasa is the livelihood. Earning a livelihood is considered a major test. And there are all sorts of leniencies for a person to earn a livelihood. There are different questions. There's a question of, can you work at a job without a yarmulke at all? Right, where even there. Now, I'm not telling you can do it. I'm telling you that there exists a leniency under the proper circumstances, right, for parnasa. It is a custom that has evolved. It's a custom. I don't want to use that word. It's a custom that has become. It's a custom that has evolved into a binding halacha. The way Shulchan Aruch writes it, right, that you won't find a command in the Torah, thou shalt wear a yarmulke, and you don't even find, there's never a rabbinic command. However, we find that in the Gemara, they did wear headdress, and in the Shulchan Aruch, it's codified. I don't know at what point. That I cannot tell you exactly at what point. But there are certain customs that remain in the state. They remain with the status of customs. There are other customs that actually turn into a binding halacha. The halacha in Shulchan Aruch is, when it talks about Yarmulke, you are not allowed to walk 4 amos, which is about 6 feet. You're not allowed to walk 4 amos or sit in one place for the amount of time it would take you to walk 4 amos, which is not a very significantly long period of time. You're not allowed to be that way with your head uncovered. So to get a job without wearing a yarmulke, there would be leniencies, right? I told you one leniency is that for parnassa purposes, you don't have to, this is, since it was only a custom that evolved, so for parnassa purposes, Rabbi Feinstein has a certain leniency there. Again, in each situation you have to ask. And there's an interesting question about a guy who wants to wear a toupee to his work, to work, because he can't wear a yarmulke. He can't wear a yarmulke, but he wants to wear a toupee, and that'll be his head covering. What's the question? So what should be wrong with that? I mean, you wear a plastic bag on your head if you want. What's the question? The question is that people seeing him might not know it's a toupee, so they see here's a bareheaded Jew. Right? Is there a problem with Marzain? So again, the Rabbi Feinstein has a leniency there. But the subject itself of Parnassa, for Parnassa, there are all sorts of leniencies. You'll find all sorts of leniencies because that's a basic human need. Yeah.
Okay, so you say you can't make you can't be involved in making an idol. So let's say you can't work at a little factory that makes those little Buddhas. But what about any other graven images that aren't made for the purpose of idol worship, but someone might?
There's something called, if it's something that's extremely insignificant, halacha, if something insignificant is not worshipped in halacha, like little men, little toy men, little toy soldiers, cowboys and Indians and army soldiers, and all these guys that we used to play with when we were young, right? So all these things are not forbidden by halacha, because they're not really you run into the problem when you get bigger types of images. As I told you, somebody gave us a statuette. A friend of mine is working in a clay factory. So he gives this statuette of a woman, right? And she's wearing a dress. I remember it was a statuette about this big, and I had the statuette in my house, and I never even realized, you know, there's a statuette in the house. And one day I just kind of looked at it, and I thought, hey, you know, something doesn't look right about that. I never had statuettes in my house when I was growing up, and here I was, you know, after I was married, I had the statuette. So I went to the rabbi upstairs. And he said, it's not okay. He said, I have to destroy it. But those that have the custom, believe it or not, in Orthodox homes, they'll take dolls. If their children have a doll, they'll cut off the nose or do something to deface it so it should not be in a full image of a human being. Right? There's a question about... The kids very often do. Kids perform all sorts of amputations on dolls and play. Most horses don't have their tails after... You know, these plastic horses lose their tails quickly, you know, and all sorts of stuff. So the dolls are also... According to some, they're a problem. According to others, they're not. Wax museums. Not so simple to be able to go to a wax museum. You have to ask a lot of authority. Because you're going in and you're looking at graven images of people. Right, all right, there it's made out of wax.
Right?
A wax museum. Okay. You know, a wax museum is where they say
art museum.
A painting is our problem. Statuettes and things like that are already problems. Right? Pictures are not as much a problem. Photographs, pictures, those types of things. Although the stipler, apparently there are those that say that if there's a picture, the more pictures there are of a person down here, the more difficult it is for his soul to disconnect from this world. The more difficult it is for his soul to disconnect from this world. The more pictures there are, the stipler. There were big rabbis who never allowed. There were big rabbis that never allowed themselves to be photographed. Right? Now, there are various reasons for it. One of them may be that he wants to work on the trait of humility. Right? People are photographing you, so it can cause ego puffing. Right? But there's an idea that if there are pictures of the person in this world, then his soul somehow has trouble making a total break and a detachment in the world to come. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, on the other hand, whose attitude I'm sure you're going to approve of, his attitude was that anybody who wanted to take a picture of him, he would allow it. Because he felt that if you get enjoyment taking a picture of me, why should I stop you from getting any enjoyment? Right? That's my act of kindness, is to allow you to photograph me. That was his attitude, which was very much in keeping with his personality. Right, so if that's what your attitude is, so then you're allowed to. But that's all Kabbalistically. There's really nothing by the letter of the law. There's nothing wrong with pictures. Okay.
So the last question, when you sleep, do you have
your yarmulke on when you sleep? You should try to go to sleep with your yarmulke, right? If it bothers you or can't, if it's uncomfortable, so you don't have to, but it's ideal that you should go to sleep, because while you're lying in bed, and you're not yet asleep, so your head is exposed, right? Your head is uncovered. It's ideal to have to wear your yarmulke when you sleep. You do not have to set an alarm to wake up in the middle of the night for a yarmulke check to make sure your yarmulke hasn't fallen off. You don't have to put on a chin strap or anything like that, you know, or wear a helmet to bed, you know, because of other things. But you do have to. You should go to sleep with the yarmulke on. It falls off. Nothing you can do. Now, Kabbalistically, there's an idea of wearing tzitzis at night. There are people who wear night tzitzis. Right, they have a special pair of tzitzis to wear tzitzis when they go to sleep at night. Right, and based on Kabbalistic ideas, right, the mitzvah of tzitzis is only, but really by the letter of the law, the mitzvah of tzitzis only applies during the day. But Kabbalistically, they wear it for some reason. I don't know. When these Kabbalistic things, you don't know the reason for it. It's brought down halacha. Yeah.
So on that, just say if one goes out at night and you shave forehead and you change your clothing, do you have to put on tzitzis? Do you go out at night?
Theoretically, not.
The custom is
that you generally wear tzitzis whenever you can, but by the letter of the law, you don't have to. You don't have to wear tzitzis.
That's basically a personal decision.
Well, it's not a personal decision. Yeah, personal decision of the Chafetz Chaim, the Vilna Gaon, and the no. It's a custom. I would say it's an accepted custom to wear the tzitzis at night. But if you don't feel like keeping that custom, then you probably should, especially then. Right. Somebody who feels like they don't want to wear the tzitzis, it's especially a good idea for them to put on their tzitzis. Because why wouldn't you want to be wearing it? That right there is suspect. But the halacha is, if you're not comfortable at night, you want to dress up, you don't have to wear it.
Just say you've got to walk to the sink outside your room, and you at night you take it off.
Some people make a point of not moving anywhere in the house without their tzitzis on. Other people are not that, you wake up in the middle of the night, you have to go to the bathroom, you want to get a drink or something, so then you don't have to grope around in the dark till you find your tzitzis. Right? But if you want to be meticulous yarmulke you have to put on. Right? You shouldn't have to grope around. The yarmulke should be right there. Right? The yarmulke should be right near your bed.
Just look at as much merit for wearing the tzitzit at night than you do during the day, because it's only a mitzvah during the day.
No, you don't. You're not actively fulfilling a mitzvah.
So, if one doesn't sleep a tzitzit on, they should rather not sleep during the day, because it's another 6 hours that he wouldn't. Like, let's say a guy learns all night and sleeps 6 hours during the day.
He should sleep with his tzitzit on.
Because that's the time he's wasting 6 hours where he could get married for wearing a tzitzit.
Well, see, why? He could sleep with his tzitzit on. Why can't he sleep with his tzitzit on during the day?
He's in a rash when he sleeps.
Oh, okay, that's a problem. You're right, that's a problem. To sleep with your tzitzit, that is specifically discussed in halacha. If you take a nap in the afternoon, should you take your tzitzis off? So the one problem, taking your tzitzis off in the afternoon, if you take a nap, that you run into the technical problem of you are now during the day without your body being covered by tzitzis. Some people say if you're uncomfortable, you should cover yourself. Some people say if you're uncomfortable, you should cover yourself with a tzitzis. Use a tzitzis as a blanket. You know, drape the tzitzis over yourself, so at least you have the tzitzis covering you.
And one more thing.
Yeah.
I believe there's a Kabbalistic thing that you can't wear and sleep in the same clothing. Things
your wife won't let you. Not Kabbalistic at all. There are a lot of things that you can't do because of technical difficulties, right? Believe me, if I get away with it.
You can't wear the same tzitzit to bed during the day.
Oh, the same tzitzit? No, right. So Kabbalistically, tzitzit, most people, tzitzit, there's a specific pair of Kabbalistic. I don't wear tzitzit at night. And when I go to sleep, I do not wear tzitzit at night. I wear the same pair of where I'm wearing during the day. But the night tzitzit for going to sleep, most people wear, have a special designated, I don't know if you have to, but most people have a special, those that do, have a special designated pair of night tzitzit.
So you should definitely
think
about it. And then, like,
and
other clothing, it doesn't matter. Like, underwear,
say
you get up and get dressed.
You want to wear the same clothing all right around 24 hours?
Sure, someone said that you really show.
Let me tell you something. A lot of people say, no, you should know, this is a principle. A lot of things you hear from people, somebody said to somebody, people do this all the time. People go, I've got a lot of things in my head that somebody once said to somebody, right? And I heard from somebody, and he heard from a very big rabbi, right? Or he heard from an unbelievable Kabbalist, right? And then you find out some of these things have no source whatsoever that's ever been known to man, right? So you have to be very careful where these things. I don't know of any source that says, other than hygienic reasons, that you're not allowed to sleep around the clock in your clothing. I don't know of any source. It doesn't mean just because I don't know the source, doesn't mean it's not so. But I don't know of any source that says that. Sam?
Can you wear a bandana on your head?
Can you wear a bandana on your head? You mean instead of a yarmulke?
Yeah.
You could, except you're transgressing the prohibition of thou shalt not be weird, right? But otherwise, it's perfectly okay. And if you have to, if let's say you're in the house and you can't find your yarmulke, like in the middle of the night, right? So grab a towel. You can put a towel on your head to go from place to place. You can put a light paper bag on your head, right? If you want to wear a bandana, you wear a bandana as long as you have your head covered. As long as you have your head covered, you can wear any type. You can wear a Sparty headdress. You can wear a hat, a helmet, anything you want. As long as you have the head covered. When we were kids, whenever we'd go to Wrigley Field to go play, you could tell who the Frum kids were at the ballpark. They were the ones with the baseball caps, right? No, and also our caps. They were all out there getting a tan, right? The Jewish kids, you could tell they were the ones with the baseball caps and the brown paper bags. Yeah. Right, because you couldn't buy anything. You couldn't buy the ballpark franks, right? So all the Jewish kids would go to the ballpark. He had the baseball bat, and he went in the suitcase full of kosher food, right? Back, you know, that the mother would pack in case he were away from home for 2 hours. Maybe the little baby will starve, right? So all the Jewish kids come walking with this bundle of food, you know. Hey, Yankel Zalman, wait for me, right? And you all go walking at the ballpark. All these round little kids with the caps, right? That was the Pesach time at the ballpark, so you hear a lot of crunching in the stands, right? The Jewish kids are all eating the matzah bread, right? They're all crunching away in the sand. So whenever we went into a bad neighborhood or a questionable neighborhood, so I always put on some type of either a baseball cap or a golf cap or something, but had my head covered.
Isn't a bandana a bit like a woman's scarf?
It depends. No, not really. It
depends what's going on with the society at the time.
Not really.
You wear one of
those
that tablecloth?
You know the joke they say. If anybody repeats this, I'll sue you for slander, right? But I'll tell you that. I know. It's good. The people at the table enjoy it too. They say, you know what a gartel is? You know what the gartel is? So the gartel is what Hasidim wear during davening, that black thing. So Kabbalistically, they wear it to separate between the good and the bad, right? And they say that Litvaks wear ties to separate from the good and the bad. And we say that Arabs wear keffiyehs with the rope to separate from the good and the bad. Now that's the joke that Hasidim make about the Litvaks, is that because Litvaks don't wear gartel, Litvaks wear ties, and ties are very modern type of thing. That's the joke that they make. Okay, let's go on. You better erase that from the tape. 215 is a technical mitzvah to not eat the prohibition, to not eat the leftover meat in the Beis HaMikdash. That means after every korban that's sacrificed to the Beis HaMikdash has a designated time period. Right, whatever the sacrifice may be, there's a designated time period. Depending, some sacrifices you got one day, you get sacrifices during the day, and you've got till the next morning to eat the meat, the owner or the kohanim. You have certain sacrifices where you may have 2 days to do so. Right, different depending on the sacrifice. You're not allowed to eat the meat from the sacrifice beyond the point of time which the Torah designated for each individual sacrifice. Part of it has to do with the alacrity of fulfilling God's will. That means if God gave a command, he wants it eaten by a certain time, so we have to make sure to try to do it by a certain time and not be lazy about our avodas Hashem. You see that even by eating, the irony is, even by eating, the Torah has to tell you, right, you're doing God's will, make sure you get the energy up, because the minute it becomes a command, it's more difficult to fulfill. Right? As soon as you're commanded, eat. If no one would command us to eat, we'd be glad to do so. The minute the Torah says, okay, now you have to eat this food, right? Well, the minute you're telling me to eat, well, I don't know if I want to get around to doing it. The Torah has to put a time constraint on when you have to eat it by. That's part of, let me ask you a question. When do you get a greater merit? You get a greater merit if you're commanded to do a mitzvah and you perform it, or if you're not commanded to do a mitzvah and you perform it, you volunteer to do a mitzvah. When do you think you get a better, more merit? When you're commanded. Why?
It's hard to when you're commanded.
What?
You just said
that it was not. Oh, that's exactly, Tosos says that in the Gemara. The Gemara says it, and Tosos explains the psychology why. That means, the expression in the Gemara is Godol. Godol means bigger or greater. Godol ha-mitzuva ve-osa. Greater is one who is commanded and fulfills, Misha'enu mitzuvos, the one who is not command and fulfilled. Because the one who's command and fulfills, he's got the nervousness of, I've got to do it. What if I don't do it? He's constantly nervous about the mitzvah. Therefore, he gets a greater merit. Now, included in that is the idea that the minute somebody tells you to do something, the natural response in any human being, especially a Jew, is, no, I'm not going to do it. Right? The natural response, the minute you tell me to do something, my response is the opposite. I'm not going to do it. Right? Jews are able to give up their lives at the stake all through history. They've been willing to burn at the stake and all sorts of endure the greatest tortures. What if they would have just asked them to bow down to the cross instead of told them to bow down to the cross? And things might have been a little different. Jew, do you mind bowing down to the cross? Oh, sure, be glad to. Right? But the minute you say, you're going to bow down to the cross, says you. Right? I'm not going to bow down to the cross. The minute that's built into Jewish nature, right? That's built into the Jewish thing. That's why we're called, the Jewish people are called an Am Kshei Orav. We're stiff-necked people. Right? When you're learning with your chavrusa, be honest. What's the first reaction you have when you're trying to figure out if he's going to, your chavrusa suggests something? Your first reaction is no. You don't even know why, but I'm going to spend the rest of the night now proving why it isn't. Right? Because the minute that's the idea of learning, you kind of bang off each other till you get to the truth. But there's certain, you're not going to tell me what to do. And the human nature is like this. So the Torah's got to command you. Even where the Torah's commanding you, what are you eating? You're eating roasted meat. Wouldn't take much to get meat to eat roasted meat. Right? The Torah says, roasted, you only have till a certain time to eat it. Like, we got to make sure that there's a time constraint, so you don't let it go drag on. You only have till a certain time to eat it, and no more than that. Yes, Sam?
What happens with the leftover?
It has to be burnt. Special place where they burn it. Not on the altar, they have a special place where they burn the leftover meat.
It was a sacrifice, but we already did that.
What, to burn the meat, right. Yeah. Depending on the different sacrifices. And the leftover meat is called nosar. Nosar, nun vav tof resh. Nosar is like the extra. Miutar. Miutar in Hebrew means extra. Okay, 216 is to, and we spoke about this in Gemara here once, I told you this comes up all over the Gemara, is to leave pe'ah. What's pe'ah?
The corner.
The corner of the produce. That means when you're harvesting your field, the farmer who is harvesting his field, no sir, nun vav tafresh. The farmer who's harvesting his field has an obligation by Torah law to leave a corner of his produce, and then the poor people have a free-for-all. Right, and they go after the produce and they try to harvest it. By Torah law, there is no set amount that you have to leave. You can leave one stalk of grain. Right? The rabbis later made a rabbinic injunction that you have to, you know why? Doesn't that sound strange? Right? Why would the Torah give a command that all I have to do is leave one stalk of grain? Right? Isn't that ridiculous? Right? Why? And then the rabbis come along and they say you have to give a 60th of your field. You have to leave a 60th of your produce is to pay it for the poor people. So why didn't the Torah just say right off the bat, you have to leave a 60th?
Something that you should want to do.
So why did the rabbis put in a rabbinic injunction? It's got to be at least 6-6. Why did the rabbis leave it at a minimum of one stalk of wheat? The idea is the same idea with, you know that during the seventh year, during Shemitah, you know, if I borrow money from you before the Shemitah year, when the Shemitah year comes along, that loan is automatically null and void. You know that? I borrow money from him. It's a great idea, isn't it? Go around 2 weeks before Shemitah, right? And before the beginning of Shemitah, start taking out all your loans, right? Try it on the U.S. government with your student loans, right? Sorry, gentlemen, it's Shemitah, right? Yeah, I don't think that'll hold up very well, right? Yeah, then you spend the Shemitah, it's not going to work. Why would the Torah command it? And so what happened in the Torah? The law of the Torah is that if you take a loan from somebody, the loan is automatically null and void. Come along, Hillel, the great sage Hillel. And Hillel, in his Beis Din, Hillel in his court, they enacted that before the Shemitah year, if I have any outstanding loans, that means, let's say everyone in this room owes me money. It should come to pass soon. Let's say everybody in this room owes me money. I can write up a contract of sorts called a prusbul. Very important word. Prusbul. I could write up a contract called a prusbul, which in effect, what I'm doing is, now this is the way Hillel, what Hillel introduced, what Hillel and his court brought in. The prusbul means that you owe me the money, right? What I'm doing is, I'm turning over with this contract, the right of collection is being turned over to the court. The court has the right of collection even during Shemitah. Right? So what has Hillel done in effect? He's figured out a way to circumvent it, maintaining consistency with the letter of the law. What did he do in effect, though? He stopped. The whole point of Shemitah is to have the loans become null and void. That's part of the benefit, is that a poor man gets a break during Shemitah, that his loans, which are outstanding, are null and void. Comes along Hillel, and Hillel goes and he introduces a principle. So now I can collect all my loans, I got no problem. Why did Hillel do such a thing? And why did the Torah command that to begin with? So the answer is that Hillel looked around in his society, and he saw that in his society people were stopping to lend money. Why weren't they lending money? Because they were worried about losing their money around Shemitah time. So you've got a situation where you have one of two options. Either people will lend money and be paid back in spite of Shemitah, or you have a situation where people won't lend money at all. Which is worse for the society? Which would the poor people prefer? They prefer to borrow and be able to pay back than not have the option at all. So Hillel and his court, because of the reality in their generation, they had to go in and introduce this rabbinic legislation. Now, what happened? Why didn't it happen until Hillel came along?